Willow Valley Communities recognizes the need for a national conversation about the Vietnam War and is proud to support the efforts to preserve the memories of those who lived through it. More information is available at willowvalleycommunities.org. The law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein and Lehr, who are proud to partner with WITF in preserving our history to enable future generations to explore the past, understand the present, and create the future. Saul Ewing is online at saul.com.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing healthcare coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by Pinnacle Health. Its 11 principal investigators and 9 nurse coordinators conduct research efforts to advance cardiovascular medicine. Information at pinnaclehealth.org/myheart.
Welcome back to Willow Valley Communities. We are on a Smart Talk road trip, and our topic is Vietnam. Coming up this September, Ken Burns, his latest, and as you probably heard earlier in the program, maybe the biggest project that Ken Burns and his team has ever done. 10 parts, 18 hours on the Vietnam War. Maybe the most complete documentary ever on the Vietnam War. And again, we're kicking this off today at Willow Valley Communities. Beautiful facility, and I have to say to everyone, if you ever have the opportunity to tour Willow Valley Communities, I encourage you to do that, because we're in a theater that is just lovely, and everything here is just, I don't know, I've heard so many people who haven't been here this morning say, oh, I'm so impressed with Willow Valley Communities. So I want to, again, thank Willow Valley for having us here for this Smart Talk road trip. We have several residents of Willow Valley Communities on our program today. To talk, they have some tie to the Vietnam War. First of all, we have Paul and Sylvia Hollinger. They're Willow Valley residents and a couple who sponsored Vietnamese refugees. Hollingers, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
And we're going to talk with you in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to speak with Jerry Zacharias, who's a Willow Valley resident and retired U.S. Navy captain. Captain Zacharias is a retired Navy captain who flew 87 missions in Vietnam, flying an A-6 Intruder. He received the Navy Cross for his extraordinary heroism on February 24th, 1968. Captain Zacharias, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
What happened on February 24th, 1968?
Well, we were on Yankee Station, flying strikes into the north sector of North Vietnam. We got a message for Commander Task Force 77 to execute a strike against the Hanoi port facilities. And they said because the Enterprise, which was our sister carrier on Yankee Station at that time, had only been on station for one day, they said make it a joint strike from Enterprise. So we launched two aircraft, flew to Enterprise, did our mission planning for the strike to the Hanoi port facilities right in downtown Hanoi, and with the air crews from Attack Squadron 35 on Enterprise. After our mission planning, we hit the SAC early, had evening meal, and then hit the SAC early, and then we had reveille at about 12:30, got dressed, went to the ready room of VA-35 and rebriefed the mission to Hanoi, and manned our airplanes about 1 o'clock and launched about 1:30. I was on the catapult at 100% power, and when they launched me, my primary attitude reference, which tells me which way is up, at nighttime you can't see anything outside the cockpit, it turned upside down. I went right to my standby gyro, which is a small gyro right here on the instrument panel, climbed up to rotated to a climbing attitude, put up my landing gear and flaps, and then headed for the tanker, which was over Enterprise.
Tanker for your fuel?
Yes.
Okay.
Get extra fuel for the long flight to Hanoi. I got up to the tanker. I was, because of my system problems of the primary attitude reference turning upside down, I was the last one to tank. I went to plug into the tanker. All the lights in the tanker went out. It had electrical failure and could not transfer fuel.
It's a bad day, isn't it?
Bad day. That's the second thing that happened in the first 10 minutes of this
flight. Yes, really.
And I thought, this isn't going to be my night. Well, with no primary attitude reference and no extra fuel for the long flight to Hanoi, I thought I'd better talk it over with my bombardier navigator to see what our options were. After our talk, we decided to try to do an airborne alignment of the inertial platform so I could get my inertial, my primary attitude reference back. 22 minutes later, we got a ready light on the inertial platform. I checked my fuel. It's going to be close, but I thought we had enough to do it.
To go to Hanoi. Okay.
So we headed into the mountains southwest of Hanoi. During a letdown, I could hear the, I call it the crickets chirping. That's a surface-to-air missile radar starting to track us. I leveled off at 200 feet in the flatlands of the Red River Delta. And I was going about 350 knots, about 407 miles an hour. I was fairly comfortable at 200 feet inbound. And I saw two missiles lift off at 11 o'clock coming toward us. And my missile warning receiver missile warning light start flashing in your eyes, and you get a warbling tone. When that missile is airborne and it's getting guidance signals, you get that noise in your headset. I told my bombardier navigator I'm going down to 100 feet. I got down to 100 feet. I had already gone to full throttle. I'm doing about 500 miles an hour now. I'm at 100 feet, and I got down to 100 feet, and I could see things whizzing by the left-hand side of my cockpit. I said to myself, geez, those must be farmhouses. Just then, my bombardier navigator said, you're level at 50 feet.
Oh,
I
wow.
said, Roger, going back to 100 feet. I watched those missiles coming toward us, and when I thought they were close enough, I rolled at 89 degrees of bank. I dropped chaff. Chaff is strips of aluminum foil, and they provide some protection from the missiles. Hopefully the missiles will explode on that chaff and not on the on the aircraft. And I did a high G turn. That's a 6G turn to the right. And one missile coming at us went right through the space we just vacated. The other exploded underneath the aircraft, buffeted it violently, and put a small hole in our left wing. And then my bombardier navigator says, you're heading to the target is 354 degrees. I rolled out on 354 degrees, doing about 515 miles an hour. Approaching Hanoi, there's so much anti-aircraft fire going up that I could see the outline of the Red River flowing through Hanoi. And we're bombing the port facilities at Hanoi. And I know we're right on track for the target. At 4:20 in the morning, I dropped my 18 Mark 36 destructors. Those are magnetic aerial mines, an area denial weapon, on the port facilities. The two airplanes before us, from VA-35, were going, after they dropped their weapons, were going right up the Red River and staying over that Red River to the north of the city. We were not going to follow them because we figured everybody's going to be shooting over the Red River by the time we got there. We're going right over the center of Hanoi at 400 feet. A roll to the outbound heading of about 235 degrees after bomb drop. And I could see lots of anti-aircraft fire shooting straight up in the air. At nighttime, it's strictly barrage fire. They're shooting straight up in the air, hoping you fly through it. And I'd pick two anti-aircraft sites, fly right in between them. As soon as they passed, I'd pick two more and fly right in between them. And as the anti-aircraft fire started to diminish on the outskirts of Hanoi, I turned to my bombardier navigator and said, hey, Mike, we're home free. No sooner than those words left my mouth than the missile warning receiver went off.
Yeah, you jinxed it.
I immediately thought, how am I going to know when to stop my evasive maneuver? Those missiles are coming from behind us, and I can't see them. Well, it didn't take long to find out. As they approached the aircraft with that long rocket plume from those surface-to-air missiles, it starts getting light in the cockpit. I said, I think it's time. I rolled into 90 degrees of bank, dropped chaff, pulled a 6G turn, did 90 degrees of turn, reversed my turn, dropped more chaff, And in that second turn, one missile went over us. Another one exploded in a farmer's field right below us in a brilliant fireball that just wiped out my night vision, almost blinded me. I were wings level, headed for the mountains. We landed back aboard Enterprise at 5 o'clock in the morning with 15 minutes of fuel remaining.
Did you go to the bathroom first?
Yes.
Well, that is quite a story.
Yeah. We did have some aircraft losses in our deployment. We lost two aircraft and the VA-75, but our sister squadron and Enterprise lost six aircraft, 50% of our A-6As. They lost their commanding officer and their executive officer.
Well,
even though we had had those losses, I think we had it pretty good. We flew in an air-conditioned cockpit, got three hot meals a day, and slept between sheets at night. The guys that had it tough in that war were the ones that had to fight it on the ground. And my hat is off to them.
Captain Zacharias, that is an amazing story, and I'm thank you very much for your service. And, I hate to use the word luck.
Yeah, you're right. A lot of
because
luck.
Because you showed, there's some luck involved, but you used a lot of skill that night as well, or that morning as well. And I'm sure that those people, your crewmates, appreciated your skill that day.
Yep.
So how many missions did you fly?
87.
87. Yep. Was that the most harrowing?
That was the most interesting.
Well, that's kind of an understatement, putting it that way. Well, thank you very much for telling your story.
Okay.
And you are a Willow Valley resident, right?
Yes, I am. I've been there for 13 years, and it's a great place.
And it's a lot more comfortable than that cockpit, I'm sure.
I'll say.
Well, let's talk to a couple other Willow Valley residents. The Hollingers hosted an engaged Vietnamese refugee couple in 1975. Many people, when they think about the Vietnam War here in central Pennsylvania, will remember the Vietnamese refugees that came to Fort Indiantown Gap in 1975 and then were resettled throughout the country. Tell us your story. How did you, why did you decide to sponsor a refugee family, and just how did it happen?
During those years, I was managing WDAC-FM, the Voice of Christian
Radio, which
is
right down the road here,
and urging our listeners that all of us listening are refugees or descendants of refugees. And there are those now at Indiantown Gap. And would you have either your family or your church sponsor these refugees into our community? And then that was recorded, and I heard my own announcement, and I felt guilty.
Well, he came home, and he said, "I'm feeling guilty today. I'm asking our listeners to do something that we could do. We had a big farmhouse. We had room." I was happy he said it because I was thinking the same thing. And so that's how we first put our names in and made a couple trips to Indiantown Gap and took into our home. They were newlyweds. They had gotten married at Indiantown Gap. They had he had to get out fast with his life. To save his life because he was with the military. He had been trained over here in the States as a pilot, but he knew his life wouldn't be worth anything when Saigon fell.
Who is he? What?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
Well, their names were Chung and Ta Do, and we brought them home to the farmhouse, and from the time they walked in the door, they were part of our family.
I think probably one of the big questions that many people had at the time, and maybe even since, why? Now, you were very involved in the church, WDAC, Religious Christian Radio Station, but why? Why did you want to do it?
You want to answer that?
Well, simply because our commission by Christ is to go into all the world. Here, the world had come into us. And this was an opportunity to serve God, to serve Christ, by taking these people into our family. And as it turned out, they themselves were Christians and are still devout Catholic Christians. And we've been privileged to have all three of their children's weddings in Southern California, where there are now a million refugees from Vietnam, to their weddings. And just last week, they were in this auditorium to hear and see the last half of our chorale concert. So there's been a love relationship, real family relationship to this family. Only 7 of the maybe 11 in that family came and merged with our 15. Mm. So it's just a wonderful blessing, as it turned out, to have had this experience with the Chungutaw Doe and their family.
Take me back to 1975, though, when the couple came to your farmhouse. I mean, it's a culture shock to begin with, coming from a foreign country to the United States to begin with, but coming from one that, as we heard earlier, had been torn by war for decades. And now, in 1975, as Saigon is falling, the South Vietnam is falling, and as you said, a lot of people's lives in danger. Tell me about them and becoming part of your family in 1975.
My first thought when we brought them home was, we'll have to live differently. And Paul said, no, we'll live exactly the way we always have. We'll make them part of our family.
Can I interrupt for just one second?
Sure.
Why did you think you had to live differently?
Well, I knew it would be such a culture shock for them, and so I thought we'd have to be more formal or something, and we just decided no. We had a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old, and our 15-year-old daughter would come home from high school, go upstairs to her bedroom. The guest room was across the hall from her bedroom, and she'd be up there for hours, only to come down in time to eat, and I'd say, what were you doing all that time? And she'd say, I was talking to Tall. Tall didn't speak a word of English.
She wanted a captive audience.
But she was 20, Carrie was 15. She was like a big sister, and they just became our children. And to learn about their culture, sometimes cooking side by side,
to eat some of their food.
What do you love?
Chutkyul. It's like a spring roll, but it has pork and other things in it. And nothing can compare.
So you learned a lot, too.
Oh, yes. We sure did.
And when they were up there talking, they had a Vietnamese to English translation
dictionary.
So that's how they learned each other's languages somewhat.
Did they have a lot of trauma? I mean, was there a lot of healing on their part?
I think so. They didn't talk about it. I look back and I think we didn't really talk a lot about what they had come through. I don't even know how they managed to re-get together. They were engaged, but they got out separately. But they could not leave Indian Town Gap, and we went back years later to see those barracks, and boy, they weren't very glamorous. And they couldn't leave till they were sponsored. And I have to say, they are the best at showing gratitude. They have, in 42 years, they've never stopped thanking us. And in a way, I say they have thanked us with their lives, because they are so productive and so hard working, 2 and 3 jobs at a time. Mm-hmm. And they raise their children to be so polite and thoughtful. And we're just so proud of them. They became citizens years ago.
That is something that you did hear often about the Vietnamese refugees who are at Indian Town Gap, about how grateful they really were. And again, think about the experiences that they had growing up, and especially, you know, being involved in the military. But that was one of the first things I remember. The time distinctly, I lived just a few miles down the road from Indian Town Gap at the time, and I remember distinctly that was the first thing that everyone said about the Vietnamese refugees, is that these people just appreciate what they, even living in those barracks.
Yeah.
And you're right. Those are Spartan barracks. That's for sure.
Yeah.
They were, you know, built
really
in the 1940s.
She wept when she returned. She wept hard. But their son, when he was 16, had a banner in his bedroom, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And he and his wife are in the diocese ministry pretty much ever since, in the Catholic Church, in the Vietnamese Catholic Church in Southern California.
So how did they get to Southern California?
By way of Texas.
Oh, okay. They went southwest first. Yeah. And
they went down there first for just a couple years, but they already knew some Vietnamese. They kept contact with people.
Friends.
And then there were so many in San Jose, and that's where they ended up. Do you have time for a really quick story?
Sure.
With them last week was their little two-year-old grandson. He was born very prematurely because his mother, their youngest daughter, his mother, her blood pressure went sky high, and they had to take the baby. And Tall, now the grandmother, kept telling me when they were here, she would cup her hands and say, "Oh, so small, so small." I cry and cry, and I pray God, and I cry and cry. And then she said, "In Vietnam," and she just threw her hand away, but she said, "In America." And it was her way of saying how grateful they are they're here, because that little grandson wouldn't be here if he had been born in Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
They're so grateful.
Thank you very much for telling your story. I mean, that's, I think your story, I'm glad you did tell that story, because that says a lot. Paul and Sylvia Hollinger, Willow Valley residents, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
You.
God bless you.
Our pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Willow Valley Communities recognizes the need for a national conversation about the Vietnam War and is proud to support the efforts to preserve the memories of those who lived through it. More information is available at willowvalleycommunities.org. The law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lair, who are proud to partner with WITF in preserving our history to enable future generations to explore the past, understand the present, and create the future. Saul Ewing is online at saul.com.